Okay, what's up, Eric? How's it going?
Good, Matt. Thanks for having me. I think it'll be a fun conversation.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So, for those who don't know, this is Eric Su. You do a ton of stuff, man. So, it's kind of hard to describe you. You have a super successful agency called Single Grain. You are the co-host of the Marketing School podcast, which is the top five marketing podcast, the Leveling Up podcast. You have a newsletter. You have a good following on social, a ton of other stuff, mastermind. We'll get into all that, but I just want to give some context for the audience, and we'll link that stuff below too. So yeah, I want to get, like I said before we started recording, we're really tactical on this podcast. This is going to be a little bit meta because I want to talk about podcast first. Your
Yep.
podcast, Marketing School, over 2,000 episodes. You've been doing it for like almost 10 years, like over 7 years, right? Leveling Up, over 1,000 episodes. You've got a really big podcast audience. I'd love to hear, like, what that, if you share numbers, what that looks like now. And then I want to talk about, for someone who wants to start and grow a podcast, what tactics have worked for you?
That's a great one to start with. So, some numbers to share. Right now, Marketing School, we get about 1 million downloads a month. And then the Leveling Up podcast, that one, it's just pure podcast downloads wise, I think it's like 30, 40,000 or so. But then when you layer on YouTube, which is the growth hack probably for the next decade or so, is when you layer on YouTube, for example, my Leveling Up YouTube channel has 4.1 million views for this month of January. Granted, a lot of that's shorts. But still, 300,000-400,000 from a long form video. That's awesome. And then we're growing the Marketing School YouTube. So that's those two things go hand in hand. I think YouTube's gonna be able to provide a big boost to podcasts and especially next year or two. So that's a good starting point.
That's huge. Yeah. So let's talk about maybe from the perspective of someone who doesn't have, they're starting from scratch. They don't really have an existing audience, which is a tough position to start a podcast in. But if you wanted to grow a podcast and you were in that position, what type of things would you do to grow it?
Yeah, so I remember back in the day, I went through this myself. A podcast is one of the hardest things to grow, like you said. And 10 years ago, when I started, I had no audience, and I was, by the way, here are the numbers. First year, I was only getting 9 downloads a day. Second year, I was only getting 30 downloads a day, but I kept going. And so one key reframe that I had in my mind was like, forget about looking at the downloads, forget about comparing to all the other people out there. And by the way, Tim Ferriss hadn't started his podcast yet. There weren't many podcasters, but I was just looking at it from a position of, hey, forget about the downloads, but it's more so about what I learn, and it's more so about the unsolicited response rate, meaning that there's going to be, when you're starting out creating content, there's going to be people that comment maybe every month, maybe every other month or so, being like, hey, Matt, I don't know why this isn't getting more views. This deserves way more views. And that validation was enough to keep me going, in addition to what I felt like was really valuable education for free, talking to millionaires, billionaires, or best-selling authors. So that was key. And then I think if I were to give you like specific tactics on how we grew in the beginning, some's not replicable. Like Product Hunt actually used to have a section for podcasts, and Marketing School and Leveling Up, it used to be called Growth Everywhere. We're like number one and two every day. We're just getting all our friends to upvote it every day, and then that helped Leveling Up grow a lot. And that's what I would say. But if I were to make it practical for people starting today, one thing I would do is, for example, Matt, let's say we're doing this podcast over here. You can either do just you can guest on other podcasts. That always works out really well. But if maybe if you're not knowing, you can do an impression trade, right? So we do these trades with My First Million, which is another podcast. We also did it with Marketing Against the Grain, which is another HubSpot podcast. Basically, what we agree on doing there is we'll trade you 100,000 impressions or 500,000 impressions, or maybe Matt, let's say it's like someone else's, they're just starting out, maybe it's 50,000 impressions or so. What that means is on my podcast, I'm gonna say, hey, you gotta check out so and so's podcast over here. Once it hits 50,000 impressions, that ad goes away, and then vice versa.
So like a cross promotion within podcasts. That's awesome. I'm seeing more of those. One question to circle back is, when you first started, how did you get guests on when you had very few downloads and maybe not as big of a network that you do now?
Yeah, for some reason, people are always down to go do podcasts for whatever reason. And so like the people that I hit up, I had already known. So I was a VP of marketing at a startup. That was the last gig that I had. And then before I came over to Single Grain. And so I reached my I think my very first guest was Rand Fishkin from Moz. And then I think I had Pat Flynn. I had Noah Kagan. So I had people that had decent cachet in the marketing niche. And my first 10 guests were, I did the first 10 episodes and then we just kind of just went on from there. So pre-seeded relationships and those initial podcasts, I was able to brag about, hey, I got these people on my podcast. Are you down to do it? And then that led to it snowballing.
Makes a ton of sense. And I want to talk to you about podcast niches, topics, like concepts, premises. So like there's a lot of podcasts that are, I interview a successful person and like kind of go through their like childhood to adulthood or something. What types of premises would you do now? And also marketing school has a cool premise that I don't see a lot. Like you do daily episodes. It's very unique. So yeah. How would you think for someone first starting out, how do you think about picking the niche, picking the premise for their podcast?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a great question. So when it comes to picking your niche with podcasting, it's really about the intersection of your experiences. So for example, my experience is one, I'm really into personal growth, health and fitness. I'm into marketing. I'm into business, right? So for example, when I do a 2-hour podcast with Alex Hormozi, we're just nerding out on holding companies. We're talking about hiring. We're talking about how he's thinking about his content, how much he's spending on his content team. So we do dive into the weeds and it will come out. We might talk about like, hey, his habits. And so that is my range, right? That's my, you know, people talk about your circle of competence when it comes to investing. Well, there's also a circle of competence when it comes to the type of content that you produce. So for example, you, Matt, you have an intersection with newsletters in addition to other areas that I might not be aware of, right? And that's what makes you. And that's why when you start to see people say, oh, good questions. It's because you open people's minds up to other perspectives that it otherwise wouldn't have seen. So like, for example, if you're to interview Alex Hormozi or somebody else was like, you might talk more about the email or the community side of things, right? Somebody else might talk about just focused on wisdom, right? So he just did an interview with Chris Williamson on modern wisdom. And it was another 3-hour episode on just Alex's philosophy. So everyone has their own angle. You just got to figure out what yours is.
Yeah, I think that's really important. What podcasts do you look at now that are just crushing it? That maybe people don't realize. Obviously not Joe Rogan. That would be like the pinnacle example, but he's doing it well.
Yeah, I think Colin and Samir do a really good job. So they interview a lot of YouTubers and they get a couple million views. I think I was looking at their channel today. I think 3-4 million views, all from long form, mostly, I would say. I think Lex Fridman does a really good job. And by the way, like Lex Fridman's kind of a quirky guy, but he gets into the science, right? Colin and Samir are more about creators. And so even in that situation, you see the angles. I would say those two are good. I think My First Million does a pretty good job when they bring on guests. And then even when it's just those two, it works out well.
Yeah, those are great examples. Colin Samir are like great example of crushing that like creator angle. Like they're the only podcast going deep dive interviews with creators about how they grow their creator business. No one else is really doing that at their level. And so good example of that angle. One thing I have a question about is some marketing school, that podcast, I think you post it 7 days a week or is it 5 days a week?
We've switched it. So first 7 years, it was 7 days a week for 5-minute episodes. And now we switched it to 5 episodes per week at 15 minutes.
I like that change up. What's the strategy behind, because most podcasts are like once a week, twice a week, maybe.
Yeah.
What's the strategy behind that? And then how do you execute that? Because I don't think you're recording every day, right?
Correct. Yeah. So the second part of your question, we batch record. So Neil actually lives half a mile away from me. So we go and record at his place. He just moved into a new place. And then we have our videographer appear and we have 3 camera shots. And usually what will happen there is I'll send him a list of topics and then he'll add his topics. And we have very different ways of doing it. I'm happy to dive into that later. But that's how we go about doing it right now. And I think, what was your first question again?
Just why publish it every single day or 5 days a week?
Yeah. So we decided to do that because even when we started 7 years ago, it's like, okay, everyone's doing an interview podcast. You know, it's an hour to 2 hours or so. What's something we can do where we feel like we're zigging, where other people are zagging? And so there wasn't a daily marketing podcast. So I'm like, let's just do that. And it worked out really well because when you do daily, it compounds faster. And I think right now we're at maybe 2,700 episodes. I know Apple caps out at 2,000, the ones that you can see. So yeah, that worked out well for us. But then we, at a certain point, we just looking at the data, we're like, okay, we probably have to adjust some things.
Makes sense. Tell me about monetization of the podcast. I don't think you do it traditionally. It's been like a couple months since I listened to the podcast, but you don't have ads in it, do you? I could be wrong about that.
We do have ads. Right now we're signed with iHeartRadio. And before we were working with a hosting company called DreamHost for about 3 years or so. And that was a really simple relationship. But that's also very hard to duplicate as well. But I will say that when it comes to CPMs with podcasts, you can go from anywhere from $25 to maybe $60 or $70.
are those podcast sponsorships meaningful for you, or is it a driver of other revenue for your business?
Yeah, when we had, I'll share some numbers here. So when we had the DreamHost deal, that was paying us about $60,000 a month. And, you know, that was pretty good because it wasn't like a lot of work for us. Because back then when we were recording, it was maybe taking us 2 to 3 hours a month of work. And so, you know, you do the return on that. It's like not a bad hourly rate.
That's huge. Yeah. And then do you have call to actions for your agencies and your other products within the podcast at all? Or
we actually don't. We've done that from time to time because Neil and I, we have similar agencies. Like technically, like we're competitors, right? But there's so much business for everyone to have. But, you know, when we didn't have iHeart yet and we stopped with DreamHost, we did fill in the ads with our agencies and it actually worked out pretty well. But I think it's just easier for us to just say, okay, let's just have, you know, a podcast advertising company like iHeart just handle it. So,
yeah. And so how should other creators or just people think about podcast monetization or yep. sponsorships? Should we have sponsorships? We have other out of the box things drive to our business. What should that look like?
Yeah. So, sorry, I just want to make sure I get this clear. So you're asking about how should people structure these deals?
Not really structure them, just maybe like high level recommendations. Like, you know, I don't think every podcast needs to focus on sponsorships, especially at some levels.
Yeah.
But what do you think?
Yeah. So I think, look, when we did have the ads focus on the agency, I think it was a good bet. And like, I think we'd get like a couple of leads a week or something like that. So I think that's certainly a good way to go about it. I think, you know, because your audience is focused on newsletters, I think pushing them to a free offer like a newsletter is pretty good to keep them indoctrinated. Like you bring them in and then you want them to stay for the, it's not a community, but you want them to stay for the continued value that they're going to get. I think that's a good way to go about it. And I would just say, podcast, like selling ads is probably the lowest, like even Neil and I say this on the podcast, like if you're selling ads, you're probably under monetizing. So the ideal flow would be you push them to either your email list or some type of webinar and then get them to sign up for something else. We're so busy with our business. I like to say with Neil, like we focus 80 to 90% of our time on content creation and then 10 to 20% of the time is actually, sorry, 80 to 90% on the business, 10 to 20% on content creation. Whereas for most creators, it's reversed.
Makes sense. I want to dive deeper later, probably towards the end of this, about those different ways to drive revenue from an audience, like a newsletter audience or a podcast audience. But I want to talk about your marketing agency, Single Grain. That, correct me if I'm wrong, has that been the biggest kind of driver of your business income or personal income?
Yeah, it has. And we'll just start with yes first.
Yes, that's all I need. Can you give us a sense of like how big that is? Like how many clients do you work with? How many employees there? Anything you can share just to give the audience an idea of what that is?
So what I could say is we have about 40 employees or so, give or take. That's including everyone. And I will say like what else can I share here? We did do two acquisitions 2 years ago. And, you know, unfortunately, we've had to do some cleanup work with the acquisitions, which is why, you know, we're just focused on, hey, we got to clean things up and then now focus on scaling moving forward.
Yeah, it's really impressive. If you go to the website, check out like some of the clients that you work with, big companies, Uber, Airbnb, a lot of Fortune 500s, and really successful unicorns too. So talk to me, you're at a high level of the agency. Let's bring it down to like the beginner level. We have a lot of people in the audience who like have a small newsletter audience, have a small audience online, and want to start an agency or a service-based business. What just general advice would you have for someone who wants to start something like this?
Yeah. By the way, I'll share some numbers with Neil too. So his agency, they do like 100 million a year and, you know, they have 800-900 employees or so. So the fallacy that I had was I came from tech, right? So I was like, oh, you know, I come from tech. My poo-poo doesn't stink and I'm too good for agency, right? And you hear that on Twitter all the time. Well, your agency's not scaling. But now, you know, the environment that we're in 2024, it's like, oh, agencies are good for cash flow. Agencies can be very profitable. And the cool thing about an agency is if you continue to compound it over years, you can, like, I know a guy, I'm in a group called YPI. I met this one guy. He's had his agency for like 30 years or something like that. And, you know, for him, he's got his private jet. He's got everything that he wants. And he doesn't see yes, it's a pain in the butt, but also like, what isn't a pain in the butt, right? So I think I would just say, I would challenge people to think about if you're looking to start an agency, like it's actually a great business. The key thing is, you need to stay focused. I see a lot of people on Twitter. It's like, hey, like you're doing an agency, but then they're also doing like three or four other things. And then now they want to start this portfolio of businesses and then they want to do this and that. And by the way, I'm fully guilty of doing that. It wasn't until I got punched in the face where I realized, you know what? Like the name of the game is to focus and just keep compounding for not 1 year, not 2 years, not even 10 years, but we're talking multiple decades. And if you're able to do that, then you can build a generational business. I truly believe that. And people are going to continue to need agencies. People need other human beings to help with things. And so I would just say to most people, if you're going to do an agency, yes, it's going to be hard. Most people just give up too early. And in some ways, they give up too early to go do something else. Or they start too many things at once. And that's why most people have subpar results.
I'm glad you said all that because I've felt all those same things over the past couple of years. I'm like, I really hesitated to start an agency because of all those things people said about agencies. But I'm so glad I actually went all in on it in the past 12 months instead of trying to do something else or some tech company or work at a startup.
And by the way, like Matt, yours is genius because like newsletters are cool, right? It's newsletters are trending upwards. So you're riding it well. And not only that, you started a community around it too. And I think people should be looking at how you went about starting it because I think that's a nice model.
Thank you. Let's talk about that. If we're going to start, just imagine someone who has maybe a small audience wants to start an agency. Do they need to focus on a niche or an avatar? Do they need to focus on one service or do multiple service? Like, just what are the basics, like foundations that I should have in place if I'm starting one?
Yeah, if we're talking about starting from scratch in the beginning, you got to take whoever comes your way. You just got to put food on the table, right? I would say if you're looking to start, like you have a full time gig right now, hold on to the full time gig until the side hustle replaces your income, then you could quit the full-time gig. I actually did that when I was 25, and the full-time gig that I was working at, they found out I was starting an agency because one of the prospects reached out to the front desk, and I got fired. That's a whole other story. But yeah, that's I think you just got to make sure that from a financial standpoint that you're not underwater immediately because that's going to lead you to make decisions that are subpar. You want to, again, have enough cushion for yourself to not be able to get turned so much by the short-term fluctuations of the market. So I think that's the most important thing. Like psychologically, that it really screws with you if you're not good there.
Yeah, and I think your job can help you start an agency, that experience there. That's kind of what I was able to do. Like I worked in a company that was good at one thing, and then I helped do other companies do similar types of things. There's lots of room for that.
And I would say like, yes, to your point, it's focusing on, don't try to do everything under the sun. Like it's just like starting too many things at once, right? And so for example, let's say Matt is really good at email. I'm really good at SEO. I should just focus on SEO first. And I'm probably known for SEO too. And then I can start to think about layering on other services later to increase the lifetime value of the customer and go from there, right? But I think it's brick by brick, one step at a time to get things going. Most people just don't want to grow slowly.
Yeah. That's really key. I want to ask you about services. That was one of the questions I have here. Because I think you might have a different take, but I feel like some services in a marketing agency or an agency are a lot more lucrative than others. If you at Single Grain could only do one marketing service for clients, do you know what that would be or any ideas there?
I think anybody that gives you this answer is going to give you a biased answer. So I think For us, it's probably something around SEO layered in with AI. So programmatic SEO, like that's working out really well, right? So we might continue to just double down on that. And like, that is the flag that we stand on, right? And I think, you know, I have a buddy right now. What he does is he does AI consulting for private equity firms. That's really focused. And he just charges each PE firm 10 grand, 20 grand a month or so, and they get a couple phone calls with him and he just gives thoughts on what they could be doing with their data. And so I think that's pretty powerful as well. But again, I do think it's dependent on whoever, like whatever you specialize in.
Yeah, let's see here. One other question I have is hiring. So agency, you got to scale with people, right? And a trend, it's not really a trend, it's been around for a long time, but definitely in the past year or so, hiring overseas, outsourcing, whatever you want to call it, is big. Do you have a lot of people overseas at Single Grain? That's my first question, then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, so I would say the size of that team is growing. I've seen some companies like 80, 90% of their teams overseas. We probably want to get that to maybe, I don't know, 20-ish percent, maybe 30% or so. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think if someone just is starting out, that might be a great first hire, especially more on like the EA type of side or VA. Any tips for finding people overseas, vetting people overseas, because it just seems like it's a little bit harder than US or North America based.
Yeah. You know, we're actually trying a couple of services right now. There's one called Remote Growth Partners, and then there's another one called Capital or CapitaWorks.com. So Remote Growth Partners, they focus on the Philippines, I believe, and maybe Pakistan. And then Capital Works, they focus on LATAM. And so we're trying nearshore, which is, you know, within our time zone, right? And then also offshore. And we've actually come across some pretty good people. So what we do is we'll run people through an assessment. So whether it's an SEO assessment or paid assessment, and we'll ask them very specific questions. And depending on how they write, how they answer, how they format their writing, that determines if we're going to meet with them or not. And if it's like haphazard, you know, they haven't put much thought into it, it's like one word answers or whatever, we're not going to give them a time of day. But we've actually come across some really good ones. And I have some friends that, you know, they like a lot of their execution team from a creative standpoint and even paid standpoint and even copywriting standpoint comes from offshore and nearshore.
Yeah, definitely. Especially on the design side, offshore and nearshore is so good at that. Writing may be a little more difficult, but I'm sure there's a lot of great people there too. So has it all been kind of like agencies and services that find people for you, or have you gone direct at all?
Oh, we go. So the way we see it is strategically, we want to hire people based in the United States because culturally, like we're dealing with a lot of people in the States or maybe like in Europe. I think there's just like, you can tell when someone's American, right? And for people where we think we can offload execution offshore, onshore, that or offshore and nearshore, you know, we'll take a look at that. But for the most part, for the US-based hires, the strategic ones, we're going direct or we're asking for referrals too, right? So for example, Matt, like if you join the team tomorrow, maybe in a week or so, I'll be like, hey, Matt, like, who do you think we should be working with? I also came across these 10 people on your LinkedIn. Like, who should we be talking to here, right? So that's known as referral recruiting. So when we have someone join, we're going to try to find more candidates to continue to fill our bench. But we do a lot of direct because the best people are usually not looking for a job. And I think too many people rely on just job postings or they rely on the HR team. So we actually try to make sure too, when we're hiring people, we ask them if they've hired people before, not using HR. And I would say like 95-97% of people maybe have never hired on their own. That's something that, you know, we look for in people.
Interesting. That's obvious, but I think a lot of people don't think about that. The best people are not looking for a job. Tell me about any like tips and tricks for hiring, because you mentioned this one thing in our newsletter group is like hire people from the Agora companies. I thought that was kind of like an offhand comment you mentioned. I thought it was really
smart. Yeah. So Agora, I think, you know, at the high point, they're like a financial newsletter or a collection of newsletters. I think they did over $1 billion a year in revenue. And, you know, we have hired people from Agora because they come with Agora training. And so Agora, they're really good at writing these financial newsletters, which means they're good at copywriting, which means they understand human psychology as well. Well, if they've gone through this entire university and they've gone through maybe a couple months or a couple of years of training, then that training carries over to you. So why not hire from these organizations that have been there, done that? So it's not even just Agora, but it's really anybody. Like if you're looking to hire and grow your email agency, your paid ads agency, it's like, well, okay, who else? Who are your competitors? Who can you pull from? Who's maybe a couple steps ahead of you where if you pull from them, like they're going to just plug in immediately and they're going to be able to help you grow a lot faster. And that's how a lot of these agencies grow to become really big.
Yeah. Any other of those companies that come to mind? I have, I probably can't say the company because I have some people working part-time, but I've hired a lot from large media buying agencies for e-commerce. You know, I've hired a lot of people from my company from those types of companies.
Yeah. I think, again, I mean, like, I'll give an example, like, you know, I know a lot of agencies, what they do is like, so some of the more known agencies that are non-holding companies, so they're not like WPP, they're not like, Publicis or anything like that, but they're still pretty significant, like Tenuity would be one, Power Digital would be another one, right? So for example, for me, if I was looking to pick off VPs or C-level people, I'd probably go look at those companies and be like, hey, Matt, you know, we're looking for a seasoned CMO to join the single green team. Do you know of anyone that would be interested? And usually like they might just raise their hand themselves or they might be like, talk to this person. And we just keep sending these messages out. And the response rates on LinkedIn are pretty high. We're talking like, I don't know, 25-35% or so. So yeah, going direct works because a lot of people don't do it. They're not willing to put in the work.
Do you have an opinion on, and there's lots of different categories. This is kind of I don't want to put you in a box here, but the question is productized services versus full service agencies. Productized services are hot right now. A lot of people talking about that. A lot of these popping up. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think product productized agencies or services, there's nothing wrong with them. I think they're very easy to understand. So it's like, hey, you're going to get this package for $1,000 a month, this one $5,000, this one $10,000 a month. And it's very clear, like, what you're going to get. Like, there's a lot of these short forms agencies that do that. And I think that's really easy to understand. But if it's something tied to, hey, we need to scale your SEO traffic, well, then it's like, how much content are we producing? How many links are we building? How much of the team's time is going to go in there? So it's a very variable cost, but productize is good because one, it's predictable and it's more of a static cost. And, you know, you can scale that out if you could just continue to hire people offshore, and hopefully that keeps quality high. For us, we're more so on the variable cost side of things. And same thing with paid media. Like, it's really easy to understand. It might be 5,000 or 15%, whichever is higher on your budget. And then it continues to ramp up from there. So it just depends on what you're building, I'd say.
Yeah. So there's no, like, it can be a good option for some people, but not for everybody. What about, I've seen a lot of these like creator focused or creator led marketing agencies. I think this is interesting. Assembly is doing this, and there's a couple others too. Is that a smart idea, or do you think that will be like more challenging than?
You know, it's funny, Matt. I actually did an interview with Sahil Bloom, and we're talking about this because he has a creator led agency, and I was just like, same question. In my mind, I don't believe it's going to work for 99% of them, because here's the thing: the creator is not necessarily an operator, and what happens afterwards is what happens in the beginning is there's this big spike. Like, everyone's like, oh my God, like Ali Abdaal started this YouTube agency, and I hope it's going well, right? Ali's a friend, right? But my guess is for a lot of these, maybe not Ali, but what's going to happen is it starts off strong, but then you have a quality control issue, right? So a lot of customers come in. How can you maintain the quality? And then what happens afterwards is the demand goes away too, if good work isn't being done. And the other thing is, how incentivized is the creator going to, like, is a creator incentivized to push something that's subpar? Probably not, because their name's tied to it. So my bet on this is in a year or two, a lot of these are going to go, they're just not going to go very far.
I see that too. And I also see a lot of creators, maybe they promote this once, big launch, and then I follow them closely. I haven't really heard from them about these things. And so I don't know what's going on there. Maybe they're just at client capacity and it's going so well, or maybe there's another reason, or maybe they're just got so much going on as a creator that agency is kind of not very important.
Well, remember what I said earlier, right? It's like most creators spend 80-90% on creating, 10-20% on the business. And then actual like creator operators, I would call myself a creator operator. It's like 80-90% on the business, 10-20% on creating. And so it's very hard. Like, you have this is the newsletter operator podcast. Like, it is very hard to operate. Operating and creating are fundamentally different skills. And it isn't until you actually get into it that you realize, oh, crap, like, this is really hard.
It is. Have you ever had a Mr. Beast bar, or whatever he calls it, Feastables?
No, I haven't.
Have you actually had one?
No. How is it?
Everybody asks, has never had one. It's not as great as I thought it would be. And so that kind of speaks to what we were talking about. It's like the product has to be there. Or people aren't going to reap. They're going to buy the first time, but they're not going to buy again, or they're not going to stay customers, right? That's great, man. So we've talked about starting an agency. I'm kind of at the point where I've started the agency. It's got some traction. I want to scale it, take it from seven figures to go beyond that. Is there any, one piece of advice or one thing or one key hire, whatever it could be, that helped you take your agency from seven figures to beyond and scale it?
Yeah, I would say in the past, I have two answers for this. So one would be, when we were able to hire people that could, we made this operations hire. This is maybe, I don't know, 7 years ago or so. And he came from Australia, and he was great. He was, you know, he came from working at big companies before on the people team. He didn't know the digital marketing space, but he was just great. He was just ready to roll up his sleeves, and he added a lot. He was a force multiplier. And, you know, a lot of people say, hey, you should hire the EA first. Yes, you should hire EA to help you with the admin stuff. Like, that's certainly a viable one. I would say for me, just the one where I felt like we started to really fly, that was the operations hire. I would say another role that's worth considering is not exactly an EA, but it's more of a chief of staff. And so, like, for example, like, you know, so for me, like, working with the chief of staff, they shadow me all the time. So they're sitting in every single one of my calls. They're seeing all the decisions that I make. They're understanding me as a person. And ideally, this is in person where they're shadowing me the whole time. And they're shadowing me for maybe 60 to 90 days without doing much in the beginning. And what ends up happening afterwards is they become a second version of you. It's like a duplicate version of you, right? And Mr. Beast has done this as well. he has someone, he's like, I need another version of me. I need to clone me. And it was the same thing. The person shadowed him for a while, and then this person's out now like another Mr. Beast. And so the more chiefs of staffs that you can have, I believe the more leverage you're going to have in a company, because this can then become the business operations unit where they just go around fixing things. And that's very much what a good chief of staff does.
That's cool. That's kind of a confusing role for some people because it's not as well defined.
Yep.
Do people, like, who reports to the chief of staff in your company, yeah, if anybody?
Yeah. So right now, nobody, but the thing here would be the chief of staff could potentially lead an entire squad of chief of staff members, right? And then, you know, he or she can become that de facto leader. And then the other thing too is, like, if a chief of staff continues to grow, like, the idea would be they can move into C-level position, or they can move into like leading like a team or something like that. So it's pretty flexible, and whoever comes into it should be comfortable with ambiguity. Usually you can hire someone that has a consulting background, like maybe they work for BCG or McKinsey or something like that, because they know how to write models and they know how to think, they know how to think abstractly. Or you could take a risk on someone that is super high talent and maybe younger in their career, and, you know, that could potentially work. That certainly worked in the past as well.
Got it. I want to shift this to a topic, which is AI. I went to a marketing conference recently, and they kind of rebranded the whole thing to be about AI for marketers. It's a hot topic, a lot of hype. I want to see, like, what you think about in general is, does the hype live up? And then what AI tools are you actually using in your business? Could be in the agency to grow your podcast, newsletter, whatever it could be. Tell us what that is.
Yeah. So it's funny. I have this in my notes over here. I have that we're working on a webinar right now. The title of the webinar is Practical Real Life Use. So practical real life AI use cases for marketing beyond just Gen AI, because that's what all marketers talk about. Everything's generative AI. And so for us, I can tell you some things that we're doing is, so we do this thing called programmatic SEO, which when you think about it, it's just like when you think about TripAdvisor, it's like fun things to do in Rome, things to eat in Japan, and you have all these permutations. These are millions and millions of pages, right? You probably, like, I don't know if you're aware of this, but TripAdvisor drives 127 million visitors per month from SEO, and the vast majority comes from programmatic SEO. Now imagine all the emails you can collect from that. Imagine all the retargeting you can do from that, right? And so that programmatic SEO, like, they rank for 8 million keywords or so, and then we're doing that for clients, we're doing that, and it's working really well. So that's an example of, it's not like an out-of-the-box solution you can build, but that is leveraging the power of OpenAI's API, and we just have that in our workflow, and it just does wonders for us. So I can give you more examples, but that's just one.
That's a great one. Give us some more if you have any. If you have anything for your podcast, sure, for newsletter, or anything else.
Yeah. So for example, on our site, we might have a page that says conversion rate optimization services, right? And instead of saying the call to action on that page saying, hey, work with our agency or book a free consultation, we use AI to create a contextual call to action. So now the call to action, instead of saying work with us, says optimize my conversions. And that's led to a 54% increase in clicks on that call to action and a 12% increase in overall leads from just running that test. So AI contextual call to actions, programmatic SEO. We also do something with AI assisted content. So I can take this podcast, Riverside will give us the transcript for free, right? Thank you, Riverside. And then we'll have ChatGPT just take the transcript and make it into a blog post. Now, that's not all. That's only 60% of the process. You actually need a human in the loop here to fact check, to add context, to add links, to add pictures. And that makes it a complete blog post. But using that process, that's driven our cost down by maybe 80% or so. And our output has maybe increased by double, I would say, versus like an original, just like all human blog post. So it's just stuff like that that helps. And I'll give you one more. We have a thing called AI contextual outbound. And so for example, let's say you work for Microsoft and you're the CMO and you visit our page on programmatic SEO. Well, we'll have all that information. We'll be able to enrich it you can use tools like retention.com. It's great. And they'll give you these B2B contacts. And I can find which page you visited, how big your company is, how many employees you have, and your first name. I'll also have your LinkedIn as well. Oh, by the way, I'll also have your email address too. And so instead of saying, hey, Matt, come buy my stuff, I might say, hey, Matt, thanks for visiting our site in regards to programmatic SEO. I actually created this recent piece of content comes from our podcast, and here's the link to the YouTube, and, you know, enjoy, right? In the PS, it might say, PS, if you like this type of content, you can subscribe to our marketing newsletter for free. PPS, if you need marketing help, you can book a call with us here. And that is now an automated outbound sequence based on the base. It's like behavioral based, and the open rates are a lot higher and the meeting rates are a lot higher.
That's really cool. Let's dive into that, because this is something that we're exploring in our agency. We haven't tested yet, is like grabbing these emails from website visitors or retention.com or other tools. Do you have, everybody's skeptical of this. So do you have problems with it? Do you have spam complaints or a really low engagement, or what does that look like for you?
No, so I would say the ones that we're sending to right now, 9% meeting rate, which is fairly high. I don't think we've tested it enough. Like, we just started testing it recently, so I can probably give you an answer in a couple of weeks or so. But you know, the fact of the matter is, like, one, you should only do this in the United States, and then the other piece is, if you want to protect yourself, like, just give people the ability to opt out. So I will report back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, can you share do you just share one message with these people, or is it an email sequence with multiple messages? What does that look like?
It's a perpetual sequence, because with marketing school, there's basically 20 new episodes a month, and we're talking about the latest stuff in marketing. And then you have my YouTube channel as well, and there's 4 long form interviews per month. And then every now and then I'll make a video myself. And so there's 24 pieces to choose from, and we like to pull back from the last 90 days or so. So it's basically unlimited. Like, we're just looking at what content you visited, and we're trying to surface the thing that's most relevant to that. And we're just going to keep doing that every single month. So it's a perpetual sequence for every single month until you tell us to screw off or you just opt out of the email.
Okay. And I think relevancy is really important in these messages, because if you send something totally unrelated, then you're going to have the complaints and stuff.
Totally.
At a much higher rate. Do you think these tools could work for newsletter operators, media companies that want to grow their email list, grow their newsletter?
Yeah, I think... Well, one thing I know, like, if you're trying to find sponsors for your newsletter, you can just see who can actually afford to pay the bucks. You can just, you know, take a look at titles and things like that. So I think from a sales standpoint, people can just look at those lists and reach out to them. Now, in terms of growing your email lists, yes, because here's the thing, especially with retention.com, they started out as a B2C company first, right? So for a lot of e-com companies, let's say your e-com company was getting like 100,000 visitors per month, they can uncover about 15 to 20% of those emails. And then you can just drop them into like your a separate email list. And then obviously, you know, these are people to retarget as well, but you pixel them too. So you don't really need to add them to the list. But main thing is, like, you can add them to your own email service provider.
Well, I'm going to test that too, and I will report back on our results. We'll have more to share later.
That'll, yeah, please.
I wanted to shift into newsletters, and we talked about a ton of stuff, but let's talk about newsletters a little bit. You got a newsletter now. It's pretty somewhat new, or at least your focus on, I think, is somewhat recent. You're growing it really quickly. We can take this in a couple of different directions. We can talk about, kind of strategize around your newsletter to growth, and I also have some questions for you about newsletters. Maybe let me ask that question first, and this is long-winded, but you tweeted this recently about newsletter monetization, and I think a lot of people don't really understand this topic. And you said something along the lines of, like, sure, newsletters are great if you're looking to sell ads. There's been some great examples. Looking to sell ads, advertising, excuse me. There's been some great examples like Morning Brew and The Hustle. But what if you simply sold a higher LTV product on the back end? And then you kind of explain the math for the advertising newsletter model versus the back end high ticket newsletter model. This is what I'm trying to recommend to people, what I'm doing myself. I don't have a particular question around this, but could you elaborate on what your recommendations?
Yep. Totally. So let's just say, for easy round numbers, your newsletter gets 100,000 opens a month, and then you're selling at a $30 CPM. And you can correct me on the math, Matt. You're the
pro. That's very average. That's a great one.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, 100,000 opens and then $30 CPM, that's $3,000 a month. Maybe you're selling like a $30 ad, maybe a $20 ad as well. So maybe you're making $5,000-$7,000 a month or so, which is good. I think $84,000 a year, that's certainly great for a solopreneur. But, you know, my take on it is, with 100,000 opens per month, well, even if you can get, like, I don't know, 0.5%, maybe not 0.5%, maybe, like, you know, we'll go much smaller, say 50 of the 100,000 opens, maybe even 25 of the 100,000 opens are interested in your service. So let's say marketing agency, right? And maybe you're able to convert, you know, 15% of those people. So 3.75, let's just call it three. I'm going to be even more conservative. I'm being very conservative with the conversion rates as well. So you convert three people, and then the average lifetime value of a customer is maybe $50,000 or so. Well, then if you can do that each month, then that's $1.8 million. So we're talking like, that's like a $1.7 million difference versus just selling ads. That's a really simplified example.
Yeah. And I think I've broken down some stuff like this on my blog too, just breaking down, okay, if you had a course, it's this. If you had an agency, this. If you had a coaching program, it's this. And it's just so much faster to a high level of revenue with all those types of products versus sponsorships alone. There are some niches like, you know, that have super lucrative sponsorship opportunities like B2B, or if you have an audience of very Fortune 500 CEOs on your email list, you should probably do sponsorships. That's going to be great for you. But most newsletters are not going to have those lucrative sponsorship opportunities.
And by the way, you can do both, right? So for us, if we're pushing Single Grain as an ad agency, but we can also push like the Mastermind, or we can push B2B ads as well, because to your point, they're lucrative. Maybe it's a $50 to $80 CPM or something like that. So
yeah, and I think when you start to build your business and convert your subscribers into customers, now you have more revenue to invest into your newsletter growth, and you have a bigger newsletter audience, and you can sell bigger sponsorships. And so that's when this business model really is awesome, not when you have sponsorships alone. What types of, there's a lot of people that just have a newsletter, they just don't have it monetized yet. And I want to maybe brainstorm with you and ask you, what types of products do you think they should think about selling? And yeah, this depends a lot on like what niche they're in, what their audience consists of, but we can just kind of pick an example or just pick an average person and give them some ideas.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of just said it yourself. It's like it's really dependent. But you know, I'm mostly in B2B. I'm trying to think of newsletters I subscribe to. Okay, let's use Axios as an example, right? So Axios was a former Single Grain client. They're more of like a financial news, or they talk about tech, they talk about everything. It's kind of like world news basically. And they actually, yeah, they sell B2B ads. So that's one example. Let's think about Morning Brew. They seem to sell B2B ads as well. Who else is there? Who else do you subscribe to?
Or what product could those newsletters sell? I mean, there's...
Instead of the ads? Is that what you're saying?
Along with the ads, if we want to use... I really think most people are going to have their product, their service as a primary source of revenue, and ads are going to be secondary. And so like for Morning Brew, for example, they have a big audience of people who are interested in finance. They could sell a product like The Motley Fool has, where it's a stock advisor.
Oh, okay. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
So what are those back-end products for newsletters? Yeah.
Yeah, so Motley Fool's a great example because it's a subscription. It's a financial subscription, right? And a lot of these finance investor letters, like I remember I subscribed to one called Quill Intelligence, and I was paying $100 a month or something like that because it's worth it, right? I'm paying $1,200 a year. I'm probably going to get probably a 10x return on that, like at the very least, right? If not more. And you could also sell a conference too, right? You can sell a mastermind. You can sell a conference. So conference tickets, there's a conference I spoke at last year, Affiliate World Dubai. And I think they did maybe, I want to say, could be anywhere from $5 to $10 million just for that conference. The tickets were like anywhere from 1,000 to like 4,000 per ticket or so. It's pretty expensive. And you know, I think going about it that way, I know Affiliate World, maybe they generate, I don't know, $15-20 million a year or so. So that's pretty significant, right? And then the mastermind, it's a smaller thing, but it's a higher ticket. So you might charge anywhere from $5, $10, $15, $25, $50,000 for a mastermind. You might drive them to a sales call in that situation. So I think it depends on...
Those are two great examples.
Yep.
Tell me about the mastermind. We'll break down that example real quick, because you have a mastermind, right? Do you charge for it? I think you have to apply and then you get the pricing and all that stuff later.
Yep.
How would you, if you had an email list, like how would you sell your mastermind? And what type of deliverables would you have for people if you're just starting out on a product like this?
Yeah, it's weird because... you know, in these situations, I would go back to my internet marketing days, and there's this concept called the 9-word email. You've probably heard of it before, have you? Yeah.
I have, yeah, but explain it.
Okay. So the 9-word email is from this guy named Dean Jackson, and there's a period of time where he had a client and he had this yacht business. Client had a yacht business. He couldn't figure out how to sell more yachts. And so what Dean started doing was he started sending emails to the entire list saying, 9-word email, right? It's basically like, yacht. It's like, hey Matt, are you still interested in buying a yacht, right? And like, that's like, I'm oversimplifying here, but it actually got one of his biggest transactions. I think it was for like $100 million yacht, just from someone responding to that, right? And for the mastermind, for example, we might send something out, say, hey Matt, you know, Neil Patel and I are hanging out in Beverly Hills August 5th to 9th or something like that, right? And are you interested? So we're not putting any link. You could put a link. You could just say, are you interested? And then you get a lot of replies from, yeah, I'm interested. Oh my God. Tell me more about it. Right. It's like, well, then you can book a link with us over here, book a call with us over here. So that's how it looks.
That is, I'm glad you mentioned this because this is one of, it's so simple, but it's one of the most powerful ways to sell over email is asking for a reply. In that example, we send a dedicated email about that. And then when they reply, we share them more, we get them to call with them or maybe send them to a sales page after the call. But you can also just do this in your newsletter broadcast. Like at the end of your newsletter, hey, are you interested in this? Reply and let me know. Or if you can tell them to reply one word, because that will get you in a higher reply rate because they don't have to think about it. Reply mastermind if you want to join. And those replies, you start having a conversation over email. It's a high-ticket product, so you can take the time to talk to these people a little bit. Yeah. You set up a call and you sell it that way, and you don't need a fancy funnel.
That's a good one. I love it.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I got one or two more questions for you here, because I'm kind of dabbling in the mastermind, too, for newsletter operators. Any tips do you have for that? I want to ask you more. You can tell me all the advice you have, but why don't we start there, and then I might ask you a more specific question about it after that.
Yeah. So by the way, everyone, like, you should join, if you're qualified, you should join Matt's newsletter operator mastermind. And so you've put together a really good group of people. And I think it's more so about, okay, now we have this good group of people. How do we iterate on a format where we can maximize the contributions from people and then also like put people, certain people in the hot seat, right? So I think there's like certain mastermind formats that you can easily Google. And they'll show you, like, if you just Google like Jason Gagnard mastermind format, like there's an entire PDF on it. So that's what I would say. And I really emulate off of like kind of what he's done and masterminds I've been in. And also like when you look at YPO and EO, they have forums, right? So it's kind of like Sampar built Hampton, but to really compete with EO and YPO. The way I see it is that you're building a mini version of that for people that are interested in newsletters, right? So you could charge like an online community type of thing for these masterminds where they pay like, you know, a couple $100 a month or something like that. And you put them into like groups, like these forums, but then you're going to have to manage all that. Then it becomes a business, right? Or what you could do is I think you can get, you know, maybe the first, your first mastermind is probably going to be like 10, maybe 20 people or so, and get everyone together, go do some fun activities, and everyone can share like things they're learning, struggles they're facing as well. And maybe it's a 2 to 3 day retreat, right? Like I'm actually doing that next week. There's 8 of us getting together, and you know, there's going to be a lot of activities. It's going to be learning. We're going to be breaking bread with each other. And those are usually a really good return. And you can either charge like a couple $1,000 for these, like $5,000, you know, $10,000 or whatever. But in that case, the group is so high powered that we're just all paying costs and we're just hanging out with each other.
For those that want to have this as a business model, what type of pricing should they think about? And obviously it all depends on the deliverables and the audience and stuff, but
yeah. So I'll give you some extremes. So it's at my mastermind 2 years ago, Sam Ovens was sitting at our dinner and he was basically telling everyone they need to start a mastermind. And he was charging $50,000 a year. And I think there was like 300 people in it. So 300 people, that's $15 million. Okay, sorry, I had the numbers wrong. It's like 150 people. So $7.5 million. And he was making $6 million in profit from that. He no longer does that, which is why I'm comfortable sharing these numbers. But, you know, you have like my friend Chris Doe, he does a mastermind for his like design community, right? And so you could charge 50 grand. And then basically he was doing like 2 live events and 2 virtual events. And, you know, the live events were like multi-day things. I think the virtual ones were too, maybe like two full days or so. Now my mastermind is just once, right? It's once a year now. It used to be 2 times a year, but I'm so focused on the business right now. I'm just like one's fine. And, you know, we charge the tickets go, you know, beyond $10,000. It just depends on when you're buying it. But it's like a 2.5 day thing. So just depends on how you want to set up. And the cool thing, Matt, is you get to decide how you want it to be.
That's interesting. And so for Sam, that's a great example because it's just such a, success, right? 2 live in-person events that were multi-days, 2 virtual events. And when there's like a, was there an online community for mastermind members too?
Yeah. So I actually invested in his company called School. So he used School for the community. It's like $99 a month. So
awesome. Congrats on that. I got to check out School. I'm using Circle and I need to probably switch. So
I would do that. I don't know. Circle's pretty robust. School is just very simple. And Sam's a big guy for simplicity. So
I like that. I mean, we have some of these school communities that have like 1,000 different channels and stuff. It gets a little bit crazy. So I like the gamification in School and the simplicity. And that's the cool thing about these masterminds. Like, it doesn't sound like that. It's not all the features. Like, you don't need to have a dozen different features to a mastermind. It's more about the people and the key thing that you said, which was engaging them.
1,000% it's the people. Like, forget about the speakers. It's really like, it's people come back for the people. And like, that's the number one comment I get from everyone.
Right on. Are there any questions that you think I should have asked you or things that we missed?
No, I think it's, I just want to reemphasize to everyone. It's cool to be multidisciplined. It's cool to chase the latest trend. I'm just saying, as a guy that's been punched in the face many times, that if you want to build something generational, as long as you stay focused, and this is a boring thing to say, and you compound for decades, there's no doubt that you'll reach a success, like outsized success. It's most people just can't see that, and they get distracted by shiny object syndrome. So just don't do that, and you'll be fine.
Thanks, Eric. Cool. Well, where can people find you? It's like Eric Sue across all social media, I think. Tell us about your newsletter too, and where they can find that, because we have a lot of people that love newsletters.
It's leveling. If you go to just type in leveling up newsletter Beehive or something, you should be able to Google that. And then you can find me on all socials, Eric OSIU. And yeah, that's the best way.
Okay. I've been following you for years. And so it was great to do this. And I highly recommend people do the same. I've learned a ton about marketing from you and growth hacking. So thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, Matt.
Cool.